It is my pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Jim E. from Pacific Palisades.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jim Miller from the middle of L.A. and I'm an alcoholic, just in case you didn't know. I want to thank Bob for asking me to come up. That's a real treat to talk at an AA meeting and to be among the people. For those of you who are new, I'm sorry it's come to this. But what the hell, here you are. And geez. where do you start? I got sober in, everybody's doing their date, right? I got sober in September 25th of 1961. So I'm even older than Roy, sort of. Yeah, and we came from the same part of town, same part of Los Angeles. We went to the same meetings. We knew the same people. We knew each other. That's a nice run, you know. It really is. I really enjoyed hearing you. I'd like to hear all of it. It was great to hear you tonight. It's great to be with you. You form attachments and you form relationships in this program that we should have probably formed with our families, but most of us didn't have that opportunity. We actually like each other here, and for the most part. And I've been thinking, you know, since we of some of those old days. You know, I don't want to give you all history lessons, but. You know, there was a time when there weren't that many of us, and we didn't have drug rehabs then. You know, you didn't have detox places. And in so many ways, I have to tell you, AA is better now than it was. There's an awful lot more people get sober now, thanks to those institutions. And I know that, you know, some of the old timers say, if you still have your watch, it's too soon. And some of those, you got to suffer more. And you hear them talk about, my sponsor was so cruel that, you know, he made us crawl through the snow to get to the meetings. And, you know, I don't know why we do that, you know. But I had a tough guy sponsor too. Yeah, Dave Hamzer, geez, you know, he was tough. Then so was I had Larry Blake. Oh yeah, these guys were tough. They were dedicated. They loved us enough to tell us the truth. These guys. Just so you know, I didn't fall off the pumpkin truck when I come in here. I was born into an alcoholic family. My dad at the time, a well-known musician. He was a very kind of charming guy, very handsome, and extremely talented in many different ways. And everybody loved him. And so it was kind of confusing to me that he tried to kill me every once in a while. And, he'd get loaded and it would all come out. It was explained to me many, many, many years later that it was explained to me that my father actually was not happy that there was a boy child brought into the family, mainly because there already was one, him. And he sort of resented that. That was a kind of a problem. I have to remember that an awful lot of his bad behavior toward me happened when I was pretty young. And he was loaded, and I have to remember that he was a kid, you know. I don't think my father was, when I was born, I don't think he was 25, 26 years old. He didn't, you know, and a drunk. And it just as an example, they used to have parties, you know, these guys, and they'd all be loaded, and the wives would be in the other room, you know, and they'd be getting drunk, and they had Does anybody know what corking is? Corking was a thing that high school boys did. They would take a knuckle and they'd hit you on the shoulder. And you're not allowed to flinch or anything, you know. I mean, big black bruises, you know. That I don't know why they do that. But these guys were doing it too. And that, I remember one night they were all corking each other. I'm a little boy, I may be 4 years old, you know, and my father comes over and they started giving each other Indian burns. Ah, you know what those are. And so he gave me an Indian burn, my father, and it hurt like hell, and I cried. And then, of course, he did what he always did, you know, he'd shamed me and said, yeah, you're a sissy, and he did all that, you know, and I went away. But I became, this is my alcoholism, I guess, I didn't avoid Indian burns after that. I became the Indian burn king. You could take my arm off at the shoulder and I wouldn't flinch. And I thought there was some virtue in that, you know. I ended up with a lot of sore arms, I'll tell you is what that was. I don't think alcoholics really think like other people. I mean, from the outset, I certainly didn't. There's a great joke, an old AA joke, but it's that everybody goes to that movie. They go to see they're Leaving Las Vegas, which is appropriate. Remember that film? And the whole audience comes out of that theater, and they're all saying, oh, my God, that's a terrible, Jesus. I am never, ever going to have another drink. The alcoholic comes out and says, oh, Jesus, that was terrible. My God, I'm never going to another movie. We don't think like other people. And yet, you know, with his alcoholic father and the rages, he quit drinking. He came on the program when I was 9 or 10 years old. And he never drank again. But he didn't go to meetings. He went to meetings for a few years and kind of dwindled down. And, you know, that rage continued, you know. He had a rage in him. And everybody in the family was scared to death of him, you know, because he would just, he'd explode. And, I mean, he'd drag guys out of cars, and he'd been sober 20 years, you know. That's how, you know, some guy cut him off. He wouldn't flip him off. He'd push, you know, he'd push him off the highway and drag him out of the car. He had a temper. And it's interesting because, you know, when I hit about 11 or 12, I couldn't wait to start drinking. It seemed glamorous to me. It seemed kind of wonderful, just the idea of it, you know. And the movies are full of stuff like that anyway, and I guess they still are, except now it's all, you know, drugs. But then it was, you know, I mean, every movie, every Western movie, certainly most of it took place in a bar, unless they were out riding and shooting at each other, you know. And if a guy came into the bar and ordered a glass of milk or something, he's liable to get killed. So it was dangerous not to drink if you're in the Old West. And in my fantasy life, I was in the Old West a lot. And the sophisticated movies were the same way, you know. Those movies, people were always, you know, I need a drink. I saw one on television. This not that long ago. It was one of the old Thin Man movies, which are before my time. I know it seems strange, but these were done back in the 30s. But William Powell was the star of that, along with Myrna Loy, yeah. And she was gorgeous, and she was in these slinky gowns. Everybody was in tuxedos and everything. And every scene opened with somebody coming through the door saying, God, I need a drink. And they'd pour a martini, and they'd drink it, and they'd drive around. And the women in these kind of silk dresses. There's a scene in that movie which stuck in my mind. William Powell is up in the middle of the night. He's half lit throughout the whole movie. I mean, he's always a little bit stoned, and yet he catches the bad guy, and all that happens. I think the dog was drinking a little too. he's up there at 4 in the morning. He's up and he sits on the edge of his bed and he's making a drink. You know, he's pouring a drink, and his wife wakes up. Myrna Loy wakes up and she rolls over and she looks at him. And she says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Well, I'm making a drink." She says, "Well, make me one." That's my kind of girl. That stayed with me. But my drinking never was as much fun as I had hoped it would be. It was the first couple of times, but then it became a process. And it got worse. I think most of alcoholics realize that over time it gets worse, never better. And so by the time I was in high school, I was drinking at every opportunity, and after that, all the time. And bad things began happening, car wrecks and fist fights and blackouts and a lot of unpleasant stuff. Blackouts were getting more and more severe. Sometimes those blackouts would last 2 or 3 days. And I would function, I guess, during that time, because I remember I was working, and I would say to people, because I had no memory of the past 2 or 3 days, I didn't know where I was or if I'd been there at all. And I would just sort of do that kind of thing, where you say, "Well, I've been kind of off my feed the last couple of days, did you notice? I hope I didn't, And they'd say, "Yeah, you seemed a little strange, just disconnected." Jesus. Well, I don't know where I was, but I wasn't there. These episodes got worse and worse, and one night I came to. I was driving on a farm road down in Orange County in California. I don't know why I was in Orange County, but I was on a farm road, and I came out of a blackout, and I'm looking at the speedometer of my car, and it was on the peg. It was doing 110 miles an hour, and I looked up, and the road ended. There was a highway, and on the other side of the highway, there were these huge eucalyptus trees, a row of them, and they were closer together than my car was wide. And I had one thought, was, "Oh, shit." And the next thing I knew, I came to, and I was in the field on the other side of these trees. I don't know how I got between the trees. Somebody or something or whatever. I must have turned sideways, and I don't know. But I had landed there. The car looked like a cartoon, with the wheels were flat out on the, and it skidded out for 100 yards or so in the field. And here's the weird part, alcoholic thinking. I was probably 3 years on the program, and I was still thinking, if I hadn't been drunk, I'd have been killed in that wreck. Never occurred to me, if I hadn't been drunk, I wouldn't have been in the wreck. I just, that's how I thought. I never had any sense of who I was, who I really was. And I had all these acts, that I'd put on for people. I would be something that would be harmonious with that. If you were a Republican, I'm a Republican, rock ribbed. If you were a Democrat, gosh, damn Republicans. I just, whatever it was that would make me, the truth of it was, whatever it was would make me feel safe. I was just looking to get okay. I was looking to get safe underneath everything, fear and a fear for safety. One of the joys of my life, one of the wonderful things in my life, is that I can walk into a room like this full of all you people, and I don't know too many of you, but I'm not afraid of anybody in here. And I got to tell you, man, that was not the case. I never let people know that. "Oh, yes, I'm a tough guy, and don't fool with me." I do all of that, but I was afraid. It was everything. When I did the fourth step, I remember everything was my part. Fear. What's behind it? Fear. I was afraid. And the drinking got really bad. It got physically bad. And I'm a kid. I'm 24, 25 years old, and a doctor came to examine me for... it was one of my acts. I'd read in a magazine where you should have insurance. Young man, young man, you need insurance. I think it said that in the ad. And some responsible-looking guy, you know, said, yeah, me? So I called the insurance company thinking that would be my, you know, it's like being a Republican. I just thought, this is a solid citizen thing to do. So I bought a station wagon, and I called the insurance company. Station wagons, in my mind, meant responsible, you know, adult. Guy, they sent a doctor out to give me a physical. They used to do that. You know, the doctor would come to the house, actually, and give you a physical and make sure, you know, your heart's beating, whatever they needed to know. And so this guy came, and he was an older man, and he came, and he took my blood pressure, and he checked me all over, and he said, do you drink, son? And I said, well, I like a beer on a hot day. And he said, you'd better hope we have a very mild summer. He says, you're dying of alcoholism. I said, come on, what are you talking about? He said, you're dying of alcoholism. Your liver is distended. Your eyes are bright yellow. You have all the indications of someone who drinks too much, and it will kill you. My reaction, I think we said this today, my reaction to this guy with this news was not, oh, my God, I better do something about that. I'm calling AA. No, my reaction to this was, kind of doctor do they send out on these kind of house calls anyway? I mean, this guy's some loser who can't get a good doctor job anywhere else, right? He's probably been disbarred, or what do they do to doctors? And I could get another doctor and get a decent opinion. I mean, I'm too young for this. And totally ignored what the man said. I continued to drink. I continued to lie to myself about how bad it was. I started throwing up blood in the morning, so I would drink tomato juice so that I wouldn't see it. Roy knows about that. Yeah, somebody would connect with that. That's the kind of denial I had. I didn't want to be what I was. It was horrifying. And I was out of control. I got to tell you something. You know, I had heard somewhere that, you know, an alcoholic can't stop once they start. You know, alcoholic has a drink and they can't stop. My father may have even told me that, although he told me very little. First drink gets you drunk, and 1,000 aren't enough, and, you know, all that stuff. But I think I'd heard some of it. And I was in New York on business, and I'm probably, you know, a young guy, probably 21, 22 years old. I'm in New York on business, and I went to the Carnegie Tavern in New York. It's right near Carnegie Hall. It was one of those old places where the waiters had, you know, aprons under their arms, and it was kind of dark and woody, and, you know, and I sat down, and I ordered a sandwich and a glass of draft beer. They had dark beer on draft, which was attractive to me. And I ate the sandwich and I drank the beer, and I got up and I walked out, and I thought, I didn't get drunk. I didn't have to go ahead and get, I can take it or leave it alone. I stayed drunk behind that image for years to come because I thought, you know, I can take it or leave it alone. Look at Carnegie Tavern. Anytime any question would come up, I'd say, oh, no, Carnegie Tavern. I got up and walked out. I didn't get drunk. Carnegie Tavern. What a lame excuse. But that's what I did. I lived in that world. One morning I came to, and I had a moment of clarity. You hear about that here, a moment of clarity when I saw really what was happening to me. I got it. It was just clear as it could be. It was clear to me how out of control I was, how out of control my life was, how doomed I was to continue that life. There was no help at all. And my solution was suicide now, right now. I was carrying a gun in those days. More alcoholic wisdom. I should tell you about that gun. I carried the gun because of a fantasy. I had a fantasy. I lived a lot of fantasies. But this fantasy was that there'd be some terrible disaster happen to the Earth. You know, there'd be one of those comets would hit us, or there'd be, you know, an atom war, some horrible plague, some terrible thing. Would everybody be killed? Well, not everybody. I wouldn't, of course. And there would be marauders, you know. When you've seen those movies, you know, after the war, these guys are riding around on funny-looking motorcycles and stuff. So I got a pistol because, you know, the marauders. The fantasy went on. It was elaborate. I mean, mostly I'd save the girl, and she'd love me, and, you know, we'd start the world again. Grandiosity was also part of my fantasy life anyway. But this one morning, I went and got that pistol, and I didn't call people. I didn't make dramatic exit scenes. I got the pistol, and I stuck it in my mouth, and I was pulling the trigger literally. And I had what I believe was a spiritual experience, an intervention, if you would call it that. And it was a voice, I think, and it said, "Hey, man, maybe you're an alcoholic." And I thought, huh? Me? No. And then I thought, well, I didn't know. I called this woman who was on AA and talked about AA incessantly. She was, you know, she had a couple of years and she was on the honeymoon, you know, like, and just all she talked about was AA, this and AA. And I drank, her husband and I drank together, you know, we'd say, why don't you go to a meeting and, you know, leave us alone. I called her up. She's the one I called. She asked me if I could stay sober for the rest of the day. And I said, of course. Even that was a lie. I didn't know if I could stay sober. But in the event I did stay sober, I went to the meeting and I walked in. And I like to tell about this meeting because it certainly changed my life. I walked in the old Central Hollywood group up there, what I remember, you know, or don't remember much, because my hands were just literally dripping. I was seeing things that weren't there, and that other people weren't seeing, you know, I could hear the occasional, you know, phenomena. Anyway. I walk into this room and, you know, there's probably 30, 40 people in there, and this woman came up and said, "This is Jim. He's an alcoholic. First day. He's first meeting. He's coming in there." I'm going, "Oh, Jesus, don't say anything." But I put on I'm a young man coming into an AA meeting to kind of check it out. Drip, drip. And she... She took me down in front and poked me in the ribs when she wanted me to hear something. But what I really remember about that meeting that was so significant to me was how kind everybody was. That I remember. I remember the kindness. I remember people really welcoming me. And, you know, man, I hadn't been welcomed in a lot of places in a long time. I'd been getting thrown out of places mostly. I was getting thrown out. I'd gotten thrown out of 6 a.m. bars. And in L.A., they had, you know, there was a law. Bars couldn't open until 6 in the morning. There was one on the corner of Ventura and Laurel Canyon. There was a bar there, and it had a big banner across the front of it, and it said, "Open at 6 a.m. Like it was a good thing, you know. And it was, in my case. And I walked in one morning and the bartender said, "Oh no, not you. You're out of here. Get out. Don't come back." I have no idea what I'd done. And I said, "Well, what?" He said, "Just stay out." I went back, really, when we were doing amends and everything. This is, you know, and the guy said, "Out. Don't come back." I said, no, I'm making amends. But AA said, "Out." Okay. Gee, I still don't know what I did. But they welcomed me in that meeting. They welcomed me. And I remember hearing the preamble where it tells everybody what AA is. And I heard it. I don't know if I really did, but I think I heard it. What I heard, I liked. It seemed okay to me. It wasn't threatening in any way. It seemed like, I mean, I didn't know if you were going to give me a tambourine when I came in. I didn't know what was going to happen. And they talked about how we're not a cult. You know, we're not associated with any religion or color or outfit. We're just, you know, and we don't charge anything. This is all, we take care of our own coffee and stuff. We do that ourselves. And we're just a bunch of drunks, so we're trying to help each other. And that was appealing to me. I think I liked that. Not that I was a drunk exactly. I wasn't sure about that. But I thought, you know, you are a nice bunch of people. And then I heard the steps. I don't remember what I heard, really. I just remember there were some kind of alarming words in there, like let go absolutely and things like that. But I thought, well, I could, you know, I could get by that. I could, you know, I fake that. But after the steps were read and they were reading in chapter 5, and they said, we're not saints. Nobody here has been able to be, you know, nobody here is walking on water. The point is that we're willing to grow along these spiritual lines, not religious lines, but spiritual lines. I heard that. And I guess the curtain came down for a while, but then this woman got up, and she was extremely significant in my life, this woman. I don't know who she was, but she was old. She was probably 35 or so, you know. And she was you could see she'd really, really, you know, hit the skids. She'd really had some hard, hard times. And her face was lined, and her clothes were shabby. But she had something in her eyes. And she got up and started to talk about hangover remorse, that feeling of revulsion and self-disgust and horror at what got out, what was revealed, what you did, who you woke up with. You know, I mean, it's all of those terrible feelings of revulsion. And I'm sitting there having those feelings, and it shocked me. Because I realized that all the people in the room were going, "Yeah, I know that," even laughing. And I thought, "Oh my God, that's what I have. If she's an alcoholic and these people are alcoholics, then that's what I am." We call it identification, you know. In these latter enlightened days, that's what we call it. I identified with her at a level I'd never connected with anybody. I was too busy acting. The good news was, not so much that I was an alcoholic, was that there's something you can do about it. And it was contained in this mumbo jumbo. It was contained somehow in this program, this thing that these people were talking about. And I said, "Man, that's for me. I think it's wonderful." I do to this day. Yeah, that was back, and I haven't had a drink since then. They gave me hope, and they gave me life, and they gave me a path. They gave me a way to go. Things I can actually do. Not that I did them, you know. I pretended I did them. I pretended everything, and so I read all the literature, and I learned the AA lingo, you know. We have a special language, like doctors have a language, and you know, different professors, I guess, have one. Well, drunks have a language, you know. We have our little keep coming back, and we have our stuff, and I learned that language, but I learned it not so much to get an education. I learned it really to keep you away. I learned this stuff so that I could say, "I already know that. Oh, yeah, I know that. I understand. I know that." And I got a sponsor. I got Blake. Well, that was probably the smartest thing I ever did. I got this guy that I knew wouldn't be impressed with a young man on AA, which is what I immediately put on that mask. "I'm a young man on AA. Yes, I'm going. I'll keep coming back. I'll go to the meetings." And we started a meeting, and I thought I'd be the guy at the door. And I would have been good. I was a good-looking kid. I thought I could stand at the door and shake hands and welcome you. I could have been great at that. I, you know, welcome to AA. I was sincere. Bring us your tired and poor, you know. Let us nurture you. My sponsor said, you're not going to be the guy in the door. I said, well, you know, why not? And he said, young man, your mouth is killing you. I don't want you reading the steps. I don't want you talking to anybody. He said, you can't open your mouth without it being a performance. He nailed me. My whole life, it had all been a performance, because I knew the fraud police were going to come and get me any minute, you know. Faker, phony. He said, you're going to be the guy that comes early to the meeting, and you're going to be the guy that sets up the chairs. You're going to make the coffee. I thought, you know, I was overqualified for that job. Although I didn't know how to make coffee, but, you know. And I wouldn't tell anybody that either. I wouldn't tell anybody I didn't know how to make the coffee. I went to the store and asked the lady, how do you make coffee in one of those big urns? I set up the chairs. I could have gotten a medal from the Third Reich for chair setting up. They were perfect, those chairs. Ashtrays, every other chair. I put the coffee cups in a pyramid. Don't mess with me. Silently. I stood behind a little coffee counter, and I stood behind the counter. People come, got their coffee. Nobody said, what wonderful cups. They sat in my chairs, messed them up. And I'm standing behind this counter, and the meeting's going on. And I started to cry. I went down behind the counter. This was still John Wayne America, you know, guys didn't cry then, and I got behind the counter thinking, ah. And what had happened was, I had connected with the group. I could have given you a lecture on why you set up the chairs and do all that it would make you feel like you belonged, right? I mean, especially if you, you know, had brain damage and, you know, it'd be like, you know, basket weaving or something, sort of therapy, you know. You can do this, even though you're less than normal. And I didn't understand that knowledge, self-knowledge, is worthless. It isn't going to do it. What did it for me was that I did this action, and as a result of that action, I felt like I belonged. I felt like you were mine, and I was yours. That's what I felt. That's what I still feel. No kidding. You're mine, and I'm yours. I belong to you, and you belong to me. And it began with that stupid thing of setting up the goddamn chairs. Isn't that amazing? And I've talked to I don't know how many people who set up chairs and do that kind of stuff. And they're the belongers. You know, people who take commitments, they're the belongers. They're the ones that Bob gets up and Roy, and these people who put it out there. You know, they go to meetings, they talk to newcomers. This guy talks to newcomers almost every day. I mean, I'm talking about shakers, you know, guys, those guys. This is service. And it's beautiful, especially for the guy who's doing it. You know, everybody can say, oh, it's wonderful you do that. Man, it's wonderful to do it if you're inside of it. I sound like I'm preaching, I don't mean to, but I just, you know, it's been so important to me. And it's still important to me. I'm secretary of a meeting today, still. I push the broom whenever I get a chance. It's part of the game. I've got sponsees. We have a sponsee meeting once a week. We do that sort of thing. And we try to learn from each other, share our experience, strength, and hope. And I found these steps were amazing. I had a lot of trouble for a long time with certain aspects of the program, like higher power. You know, I got very confused about that. And for me, everybody gets to have a higher power that they click with, you know, that works for them. Doesn't have to be your mommy's higher power, your daddy's, or the minister's, or it's just what's working for you. What works for you? Might be the power of this group. There's a lot of power in this group, I'll tell you. There's something going on here that's bigger than me. And I can rely on that not to screw me up. I can talk to that. I just grab one of these guys and say, you know, hey, man, you could probably grab a stranger walking down the street and tell him your troubles. He'd say, Jesus, don't do that. You know, I mean, my thinking is not too clear. So now I'm thinking about this, and I went to the divine, whatever that is. It, she, it, I didn't know. And I said, look, can you reveal yourself to me, please? I'm confused. I don't want to be confused. Can you reveal yourself to me in a way that I can understand? And again, this is an individual experience. This is what I experienced. I had another one of those funny mystical moments. It was like click. And I had a picture in my head of my mother's church, the wall of her church, that when I was a little boy, you know, she'd take me into church. And the wall, there's a blue wall and a gold letters, and the gold letters said, God is love. That's what hit me. I thought, whoa. Well, you think? Really? It had just been something I said or people would say. But love itself. And it all kind of started making sense. And I'm talking about love. I'm talking about love and all the things that devolve. Goodness, if you like. Kindness. Compassion. Joy. Sex. All the good stuff. Stuff you like. Stuff you want to do. Little kids. Fun. Reaching out. Being reached when you need it. All those things. That's God itself to me. And practically speaking, I have time. I'll tell you a quick story about how it worked for me practically. We were talking about it earlier. It worked with my family. It worked with my father. Everyone in the family was scared of my father. Everybody walked on their toenails. Don't get him pissed off. They talk like that. And I felt that way too. I'd never thought about my father without having some sense of anxiety and discomfort. And I didn't like the way I felt about him, but it had always been his fault. Yeah, he beat me up. He tried to kill me. He did all these terrible things. He always competed with me, made me feel little. It's his fault. He owes me an amends. And as soon as he makes an amends, I'm going to be a happy person and have a wonderful life. There was something wrong with that thinking. And I have come to understand that, you know, while a lot of things happened to me that were unpleasant and everything, my life is my responsibility. And if I'm going to have a good life, I've got to have it. He can't give it to me. You know, they call that the magic phone call. You know, mom and dad call up and say, listen, we were wrong. You really are a terrific person. And from here on out, we're going to be the people that are behind you all the way. We're going to be parents. And we're going to love you like crazy and stand by you. We'll even lend you money. I mean, we're going to be there. That's the magic phone call. I don't know if anybody's had one of those. I didn't. So I realized that my life was my responsibility, and I didn't know how that would look. I didn't know what to do. The question came into my mind, are you willing to have a healing take place? Are you willing? It's a big word around here. Are you willing to have a healing take place between you and your dad? I wasn't so sure. I kind of liked being, you know, it's your fault. I kind of, you know, sort of j'accuse. But I again, I didn't like how I was feeling. It didn't make sense. And I thought, okay, what does it here? I don't know what it's going to look like. That's one of the hard parts. You don't get to know what it looks like. But I said, okay, I'd like to have a healing take place. I'd like to be able to see my father through divine eyes instead of the way I've been seeing him. I'd like to see him. How would love look at this guy? And the minute I said that, that sense of anxiety in me disappeared. Just, it was anxiety? No anxiety. It just went away. And I went to see him. I hadn't seen him in almost a year. I went to see him. They were living not that far away, and my dad and I had worked out a way to be together where we could, you know, we could talk about, you know, baseball and, you know, stuff like that. It was safe stuff. But anything else, never talked about. And I was sitting with him, watching a ball game, of course. And my mother came in the room, and my father made some crack about me. Some disparaging remark. I don't remember because it was so common he did that. But something that really put me down. But it was said in the form of a joke so that if I didn't like it, I couldn't take a joke. Yeah, that's a good technique, by the way. That's a, I've used it myself. But he did that, and I turned to my dad, and I said, Pop, and it just came out. I said, Pop, I really wish you wouldn't do that. He said, what? I said, I wish you wouldn't put me down in front of Mom. It feels lousy. It always did. And I'm asking you, please, can you not do that anymore? And, you know, a part of me's up in the corner of the room looking down saying, Jesus, you said that? And he exploded. He went volcanic. I mean, he was raging and fulminating and calling me every name he could think of and rah. And I wasn't upset. I wasn't trying to placate him. I didn't mean it. Take it easy. Nothing. I was just watching him. And I began to feel bad for him. What I was feeling was love in its form of compassion. I was feeling bad for this guy because I realized why he did this. He did it because he was afraid. He exploded and raged when he was scared. And it was a great revelation to me. I thought, oh my God, my father's afraid. He was afraid. This was fears. And I saw it just clear as it could be. And I got up, I said, I'm going to go order the plants or something because I was afraid he was going to have a stroke. You know, he was like purple. And I went outside and I was just marveling. And I said, thank you to my higher power, love. Thank you for showing me. I didn't believe it could come like this. And I went back in the house. I sat down, and I could feel him, you know, next to me. And he reached over, and he patted my leg. My father never touched me. Patted my leg. And he said, well, my old man used to do stuff like that. And I started to cry. I just went. And then he started to cry. And we put our arms around each other. And we're both bawling. And he said, cut it out, God damn it, you're making a dame out of me. And we fell in love. This guy and I, we fell in love. And we talked and we were close and we had some great years. And I had the privilege of helping him die. It was an amazing experience. And what had happened simply was that I was able to say, I am willing to have a healing take place. I'm willing to see him differently. It's worked in every way I can think of. It certainly worked in my marriage. My wife passed away 3 months ago. 4 months ago, today, yesterday. Ah, got it. And in our relationship, you know, these kind of things happen between the closest ones to you. You know, I can prove she's wrong. I can prove she's a bitch. I can, I get witnesses. You know what she's like. Am I willing to have a healing take place in my attitude? Can I see her through divine eyes? And when I did, some amazing things happened. You want me to tell that story about you too? Don't you? Okay, I'll do one more story. I was in Florence in Italy, and I was just blown away. You know, that's the home office of art. I mean, great art is like Florence. And I'd walked into this kind of obscure little museum called the Duomo Museum, and it was full of sculpture, incredible sculpture. And it wasn't that really, you know, idealistic stuff, you know, they're all kind of beautiful people. It was like real people, you know, the faces were there. 500-600 years ago, these things were carved, and they were amazing, amazing. And I was blown away, and I walked into one of the galleries, and there was a figure there in wood, dark wood, of this ragged woman, ravaged face. And she was Mary Magdalene. And I'd never seen a Mary Magdalene in that thing. She's called the Madonna of the Streets or something. She had a name like that. And you knew, looking at this figure, that, man, this was an old hooker, man. She'd been working the alleys. She was, you know, not good. But she was posed in such a way, and he caught an expression on her face that was filled with amazement and hope. And the words jumped into my mind. And the words were, "You mean me? You mean me? Somebody like me? I can have this." And I had to sit down because it really got me. She was like that woman at my first meeting. She was like us. She was like me. I had that feeling. "You mean me?" And these two English ladies came into the room behind me, and one of them looked, and she said, "Oh, look, that man's crying." And the other one said, "Yes, don't you see?" And she came and sat behind me on this bench, and she put her hand on my back, and she wept. She was one of us. She was an alcoholic, down from England on a vacation with her friend. Man, we're everywhere, you know, and this feeling is just free. It's free for the taking. Thanks for having me in. God bless you.